curated the Society's exhibit for Summerfest's 50th anniversary. Those of you who were in the early days of Summerfest, we'd love to hear from you and some of your favorite concerts and all of that this hour. I do have an announcement to make at the end of the show today, which you may want to pay some attention to. So that's coming up the last 5 minutes. Well, Summerfest. Now, is it the 50th anniversary? 1968 was the first festival, but it's 50 years of the festival? I don't get it.
I had trouble with the math, too.
Did you?
Yeah. But it is the 50th anniversary, so they'll
It's the 50th festival.
Right.
So. Okay.
That's why they decided to celebrate this year.
Okay.
So if your grandson's 3 years old, 1, 2, 3, you know, so he has his...
Oh, so it's the year, so right. I got you.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I got you. And who had this idea? Was it the former mayor, Henry Meyer, was it his idea?
It was, but it goes back much farther than that, Kathleen.
Really?
This goes back to 1933 and even earlier.
1933?
Yeah.
You're kidding me.
It's when beer came back in April of 33, and they had a very elaborate Folksfest at the Milwaukee Auditorium. And people liked it so well, they decided to make it a permanent event. So for 8 years, from 33 to 41, Milwaukee had something called the Milwaukee Midsummer Festival on the lakefront. And it was a huge draw, in part because it was free. So this is the Depression. No, this is the very depths of the Depression. And then World War II, obviously, is when it ended. So they had, what were some of the events, Ben, do you recall from the Midsummer Festival?
Oh, there was a beer garden, there was restaurants, there was, you know, carnival games and rides and things like that. I think it was really, you know, ran the gamut of festival type fare and events.
They had some strange things. They had motorcycle hill climbs above Bradford Beach. They had swimming races, including one for dogs in Lake Michigan.
Oh, did they really?
They did.
For dogs?
And
oh.
they had these pageants that were just hilarious. It was not intentionally. This is back in the time when WPA workers, you know, people like you or I or Ben, would have been hired, you know, to work in WPA to kind of keep the cultural quotient up a little bit. And they had these pageants that would include things like the symbolic wedding of the land and Lake Michigan, with King Neptune presiding, with all these sort of, you know, young women in flowing gowns, very, very Greek, very heavy-handed symbolism. But the kind of thing that would have been fun to see now.
They should bring
kitschy.
That back. Wouldn't it be fun to have that part of the festival now?
And it was free. This is all, you know, work relief funding, and they had some of the exhibits that Ben has, or some of the pictures you got in the Society's collection, the County Historical Society. I can recall seeing pictures of the exhibits of extension homemakers and forestry today and you know, kind of all these things that were maybe not as riveting as current fare,
right.
but they were free.
Yes.
So did they start out in 68? Let's go to 68. That's an amazing history, though, John. Did they start out wanting to have a rock and roll festival, or was it supposed to be a family festival? What was it, and where was it? It wasn't on the Summerfest grounds.
No, I mean, Henry Meyer's original idea was a really broad-based festival. He wanted a little Olympics. He wanted lots of celebrities here doing appearances. So it was a music festival, but he wanted it to be a lot more. It was actually modeled off of Oktoberfest in Munich more than just a rock and roll festival. You know, it wasn't supposed to be the next, or it wasn't supposed to be what Woodstock was or anything like that. It was supposed to really be a number of different events. And in its early years, it really was. I mean, you had rock shows, but you also had the symphony performing. You had the very first year they had a couple of South African musicians come and play. And so it really was supposed to be a cultural event more than a rock show initially.
Mm-hmm. And back in those years, I think the first 2 years they had 35 different venues. So they were just all over the lot.
Goodness.
And it ranged from clay court tennis matches to folk festival to symposia on kind of women's progress, gospel festival, gospel music festival. So it really was all over the lot. And my favorite story from that first festival back in 1968 was they had a folkloric troupe called the Flying Indians of Acapulco. And
John, only you would know this.
one of the events was they had a simulated ceremony of kind of appeasing the rain gods, which involves stripping a young woman to the waist during every performance.
Oh, my goodness.
So this went on again and again, which drove ticket sales through the roof.
Imagine. Oh, my goodness.
So it was very controversial, and there was one Summerfest official who tried to sort of downplay it. He called it a tempest and a sea cup. One of the great lines. they were not invited back.
Oh, mm-hmm. No. Oh, do you have that in your historical exhibition?
No, we didn't include that piece. No.
You should have. You should have more people going to the exhibit, definitely. Probably. So what happened during the racial disturbances in this country, and was there an attempt on the part of Summerfest to include groups to make sure that people had something to do other than be in the streets, or what was the reaction of Summerfest to that time?
Sure. Henry Meyer, in his autobiography, definitely alludes to Summerfest as an effort to sort of heal the city and bring positive attention to Milwaukee on a national level. And so there were some effort made to include different groups. Now, initially it was a token effort, and there was some backlash in the initial planning in 66, 67 for not including enough diversity and other people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the aftermath of the riot and civil unrest, they created a committee, and one of the goals of this committee was to sort of beautify the city through arts. And so for Henry Meyer, the Summerfest was a perfect opportunity to do that to some effect.
Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a realization of Dan Hone's vision, too, talking about all people playing together as one city for the greater glory of the community we all love. So there was, you know, some fairly kind of high-toned civic symbolism, you know, in having all the variety of acts and trying to be, I think Ben's right, it was perhaps more lip service than it might have been later on, but Miriam Makeba, Hugh Masekela, you know, there were some groups that our generation recalls,
yes,
you know, from those early years.
But that was kind of a continuing theme. I've lived in this city for a long time, and there's always been an undercurrent that there have not been enough minority acts as a part of Summerfest. Has that changed over the years significantly? Are there now?
I would say it's become much more pop music driven, and so you get the diversity that's reflected in popular music. So, you know, there's been efforts to include more hip hop and rap and things like that. And then there have been over the years ethnic bands and groups, and so there's been a push. But one of the criticisms of Summerfest is that the music tends to skew towards a certain generation and a certain fan base, and maybe isn't as all-encompassing as it could be.
I think what's happened to Summerfest over the years, early on, it was the jazz was at the Miller stage.
Right,
Schlitz was country. There was kind of a blues venue. There was comedy. It was much more kind of silo-ized than it became. And I think that reflects the changes in American music. You know, the genres kind of bleed into each other. So now when I go on the Summerfest grounds, I have no idea, you know, kind of what the theme is in any particular stage. And I think that kind of reflects what's going on in the larger society.
So you're going tonight. Are you going to hear a specific group, or you just like to go to Summerfest?
No, speaking of diversity, the baby boomers, last year, Bruce Hornsby was there. The year before, Taj Mahal was there. B.B. King's been there. Kind of people whose records I own.
You still have the records?
I probably still do, but, you know, CDs or, you know, now you stream. This year, there is no single. I missed Paul Simon. We were out of town, which was just last weekend.
Right.
And coming up, we've got I couldn't afford the tickets for Willie Nelson and Family and Bob Dylan. So those were kind of the boomer acts. So I have no idea what's going on tonight, but I really enjoy going down there and just kind of absorbing the buzz.
Yeah.
You know, it's not my demographic anymore, but I just like the life.
But you're
the
still
life.
A kid at heart, or young at heart, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's play a little bit. We have some of the people who have performed. This is not what he performed at Summerfest, but we'll tell the story, which has become pretty famous. This was one comedian's appearance at Summerfest. This is not what he said, though, at Summerfest, because we can't play it on the radio. Oh, dear. We'll have to play it in a moment, so let's not do that. We'll get back to that in a moment.
So seven words you can't play on the radio?
Yes, that we couldn't. We were going to play the seven words, but we may as well talk about what happened historically. We were going to play George Carlin doing another piece, but he made hay out of that, didn't he?
He
really made his career more prominent as a result of
that. Yeah, nothing like getting arrested to boost your ratings.
Exactly. Was that necessary? Why did that happen? We can't say what he said, but people know what the seven words are, I think. Bob? Ben. I'm going to continue calling you Bob. Ben.
Yeah. you know, there were morality laws, decency laws in place. So it's not surprising that they made an example of George Carlin at that point with the arrest. I think Carlin did it, you know, to make a splash. I've heard other stories about his appearances in other cities where he was, you know, he could be somewhat incendiary. So I think it was just sort of two factors meeting. And obviously it made a big splash nationally as well.
Yeah, it sure did.
I think it was also probably there was some heavy-handedness on the part of the authorities at Summerfest. You know, Henry Jordan, you know, who was the Green Bay Packer, who was there's that famous picture of this big, hulking, you know, Green Bay Packer, you know, retired by that time, kind of escorting this rather diminutive George Carlin off the stage. So they might have let that pass and chose not to, but the result obviously was good for Carlin's career.
Mm-hmm. And was he put in jail then, Ben?
I believe so, but I can't imagine he stayed in jail for long. I don't know the details of the arrest. So.
But the charges were dropped. I think I read by
they
December.
They were. Yeah. Yep.
So were comedy acts a big thing? I know Bob Hope appeared at Summerfest at one point, too. Mm-hmm. Was there a comedy stage?
There was. How many years, Ben?
Several years. I mean, the comedy stage was there probably 15 or more years. It was actually replaced by the amphitheater, I believe.
Huh.
But, yeah, it was a big part of the show. And a lot of nationally known comedians came.
Billy Crystal.
Yeah,
Jay Leno,
Joe Piscopo, another number of really famous people, especially in the 80s, were there.
Well, why did they drop that? We could always use comedy. It's a good idea.
It's a good question. Was it the venue needed the space?
I think the big thing was the venue, and they probably felt they could draw more people for a big name music act rather than a comedian. And I think, I mean, I could be wrong about this, but I think stand up comedy is kind of fading as a a viewer entertainment or live entertainment as well.
And I think the more logistical reason is it's really hard for one voice to compete with all those amplifiers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having one comic down there would have been fairly hard duty. And it's important to underline, not everyone knows, that for the first 2 years, Summerfest was every place, and it came to the lakefront in 1970. That was the very first year that it was one single venue, and they've just grown like crazy ever since.
Yeah.
You know, in that sense.
And was it Meyer's vision to have not only Summerfest, but also Italian Fest and Irish Fest and Polish Fest and all of those? Was that the grand idea?
That was a happy accident.
Was it really?
And it was basically in 1978, Milwaukee's Italians, the Sicilians, you know, sort of a distinction between those two groups. Sicilians are part of Italians, but quite different. That's their old neighborhood. The Third Ward is where they grew up. And it was bulldozed first for urban renewal and then for the freeways. So they were nursing wounds. So the Holy Name Society of Our Lady of Pompeii Church back in the mid-70s begins to think, how about a reunion on the grounds in our old neighborhood? So it was them. It was they who started it, and that was the first held back in 1978. And it was intended early on, pretty much as an event for the Sicilians, and everybody came. And that touched off, you know, this wave of ethnic festivals. So it was something that certainly would have been very harmonious with Meyer's vision, but it happened on its own.
Interesting. We welcome phone calls for those of you who have been to Summerfest, and I would imagine there are some listeners, maybe you don't go back 50 years, but maybe some of you do, actually, and can remember those early days of Summerfest or some acts that you saw that were absolutely terrific. I'm interested because these are fairly small stages when you consider the kinds of stages that, say, the Rolling Stones would play on. It's not the size of Summerfest. It's usually, you know, huge. It's a football field. So how are all of these people? And we'll talk about some of the people who have been here and some amazing talent has been here. What are your memories of Summerfest? We'd like very much to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. All right, our number is 800-486-8655. And we're getting memories of Summerfest this hour of the program. We're going to go to many phone calls that are coming in, but let's talk about some of the acts that have been brought here. I would think, you know, I would love to be in on some of the conversations because we do that too, booking people to be on the show. But to book the Rolling Stones to come to Milwaukee to a stage that's probably small for them, how did people do that? Ben?
Well, I think there's a definite draw to appearing at Summerfest. You know, you hear from some of the acts that come here and how it's a highlight of the year for them. But yeah, I mean, the Rolling Stones are a great example. They everywhere on that tour, they played 75, 80, 100,000 seat venues, and then they came to Milwaukee and played 23,000 seats. And there's just something about the festival, there's something about the really appreciative audience that draws them in. Similarly, Pearl Jam, when they were in the middle of a dispute with Ticketmaster, they canceled most of their tour, but still made their appearance
really?
At Summerfest as well. So some of these really prominent acts just enjoy playing here.
Huh. I think it's also part of the, you know, the old Folks Fest idea. You know, it belongs to all of us. Admission's fairly reasonable. So people like acts like bands like the eclecticism
right.
and the approachability, you know, that you don't get in some of these gigantic festivals, you know, where it might be $150 a ticket. So it's has a nice attraction for the musicians.
That is true. You can wander around and see all of these musicians, mm-hmm. and you're not paying. It's probably more than $150 for some events.
Yeah, what I've always said is if you can't find something to like on any given night at Summerfest, you're being way too picky, you know,
right.
because
mm-hmm.
diversity is really their calling card.
Yeah. So are there concerts that really stand out in your mind?
One of the first, Sly and the Family Stone.
Oh, and we have music from that. I hope this board gets working because I want to hear them too.
That was back in 1970, and back then, no, they didn't have a main stage. All they had was kind of these trailers perched on concrete blocks. And I can recall that. I was kind of somewhere past the middle, and he was at least an hour late. And there are all kinds of stories about why he was late. He was afraid. He wanted marijuana. He wanted a watermelon. He wanted a limo. You know, there are all these legends that have grown up around that famously delayed appearance. He was an hour late when he went on, and by that time the crowd had gotten fairly ugly. I can recall chairs kind of being at least maybe not thrown enough to hurt somebody, but they were kind of tearing up the what was there of the grounds, which wasn't much. He finally came on and it was a good show, but that was kind of an early Summerfest low point.
Yeah. Are there a lot of people who show up really late?
I think that tends to be something of a musician's tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does.
Yeah,
it?
Definitely.
An hour, though, that's kind of
a long
that's
time.
Pushing the envelope.
Yeah.
Right. And other memories, Stevie Wonder playing with John Legend. I believe it was during the day that Michael Jackson died, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think that's correct, yeah. An interesting thing about the Sly and the Family Stone show, we, as part of the exhibit, we reached out to the community and asked them to submit, you know, photographs or artifacts or something like that. And the band that opened for Sly and the Family Stone, one of the members of that band submitted a photograph. And it's a great shot of this. It's just a local band, you know, who would have played, you know, a rock club or something like that to in front of 100 people or something like that, playing in front of, you know, this crowd of nearly 100,000 people because they just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls. We have a lot of people who want to share memories. And we start with Holly in Madison. Hi, Holly. Holly? Hi, Holly. I'm not sure everything is working here. Hello, Holly? Well, let's try Ray in Rhinelander. Ray? I'm sorry. Well, we'll just try and fix something. Go ahead. John, were you going to say something?
No, but certainly Sly, he was a very popular act, and back in those days it was not just the improvised stages, but the benches weren't much. So you had some rather surly people, you know, who were used to perhaps better treatment, who were either standing or kind of in these rather makeshift bleachers. So it tested the patience, you know, of the audience.
Yeah. Let's go to some of the storms that took place. July 6th, 1986. Is this true? The water was so deep that fans reportedly dived off picnic tables and swam out of the main stage entrance. Did they really?
Maybe. I've talked to people who are at that show. They've talked about the water being knee deep or maybe thigh deep as well. the person I talked to said he didn't see anybody actually swimming out of the venue, but that the water was definitely quite deep. So it's possible.
Is this how, what's in the exhibition?
So we have, it's very visual, lots of photographs, and then we also have a lot of memorabilia and artifacts from Summerfest that they've collected over the years.
Ticket stubs and programs.
Yeah, ticket stubs, programs. So we have some programs from 1968. We also have some, my favorite part are the newspaper clippings from like 1962 through 1968, so you can see the planning stages and all the different sort of iterations of the festival over the years, and it's interesting to just, I mean, we think of this major festival as an inevitability, right? It's the big highlight of the summer. But right. If you look at these early years, they didn't have any idea if they were going to be able to pull it off. They didn't know if it was going to work. After the 1969 festival, it was heavily in debt, and that was almost the end. So it's really cool being able to trace that history through a lot of the artifacts and the images that we have in the exhibit.
Did they make money the first couple of years, or did they think they wouldn't be able to continue because they weren't making money?
I think the first year they made something like $5,000.
Oh, no.
But that was considered a win.
Uh-huh.
And then the next year, there were something like $165,000 in debt. But they were bailed out by some local businessmen, and they took out a big loan to cover that loss. And then ever since then, they've sort of been on the positive side of the books.
Yeah. So. Have there been certain figures who were genius, either musical geniuses who were able to persuade all these acts to come, or financial geniuses who allowed this to become the success that it has been, some real guiding lights of Summerfest?
Probably Bob Babish, and it would be near the top of the list as their booker. Began as a stage manager and rose to the point where he's the guy who's, you know, booking all these acts. So he has contacts in the industry that are his frequent contacts is probably to die for among people who are in the industry. Other people, you know, legendary people like, you know, Milwaukee has not always had, we don't have a surplus of celebrities, but Bo Black, you know, was kind of certainly a very visible figure for a number of years in Milwaukee. Henry Jordan before her. Don Smiley brings a bit of a Vegas style, I think, in some ways, to the entertainment part of Summerfest. So there has been a number of figures who've been figured very, very largely in the success of that festival.
So the smiley face came from Don Smiley?
I don't think so.
No,
I think
it's coincidence.
I think he came.
It's just
came
a coincidence.
Later. Another happy accident.
Yeah. The smiley face dates to, I believe, 1970. So it's been the logo for a long time.
Is it time to change it?
I think at this point you'd have another riot on your hands if you tried to change the logo.
Do you really think so?
I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, it definitely seems dated, but at the same time, it is iconic, and it really is part of who they are.
It's kind of like the old Milwaukee Brewers, the glove logo, you know, with the MB. You know, that's also iconic, and they've moved on from that, but bring it back periodically in T-shirts and hats. So it's part of the folklore, and certainly the smiley face will endure for
will,
a
huh?
long time.
I'm
going to
try this phone one more time. Holly, are you there?
Oh. Talking about that venue, Kathleen, back in 1970 when they moved to Summerfest, that was not what you would consider prime in Milwaukee. Back in those years, it had been early on landfill, then it was a freight yard, it became a downtown airport, and then in the 50s it became a Nike anti-aircraft missile site.
Oh my gosh.
So it was a military installation. And if you were a Cub Scout or Boy Scout in Milwaukee and it had kind of a male appeal, they would bring you down there and kind of raise the missiles off from these underground bunkers, open the doors and kind of raise them into firing positions. So it's fairly dramatic. So that was pretty much off limits as a security area for a long time as well. And then they pulled out because the threat of Soviet bombers coming over the North Pole was no longer as real as ICBMs kind of coming over, which were harder to shoot down. So that whole defense strategy went away, and it was surplus territory. And it's not well known, but the Summerfest administration grounds, the old ones, the old administration building on the east side of Lincoln Memorial Drive, that is part of the old Nike anti-aircraft missile
site. Oh, it is.
So,
fascinating.
Very barrack style.
Was there controversy about putting it right down there? Did people want to keep that for something else, maybe just a park for everybody?
No, because Lincoln Memorial, that's the cherished ground. That's the one where you'd have a fight in your hands if you tried to do anything. To denature that, literally.
Yeah.
But the Summerfest grounds, that had been so non-natural for so many years that it was kind of a logical spot. And that goes back to 33, back in the Midsummer Festival. They were having the event down there. So there was ample precedent for that being used as a kind of a civic festival grounds. Mm-hmm. So no resistance. I think that was widely embraced.
Mm-hmm. And what about families? Has this become a family-friendly thing, or is this, are most of the people who go to Summerfest these days young people, you know, who go to be with other teenagers or people in their 20s? And then John, of course, goes
right
to it.
I'm the outlier.
I think, you know, during the daytime, it's family friendly. And there was a concerted push in the 1970s to make it family friendly after a few outbreaks of violence and drunkenness in the early 70s. They made a big push to make the grounds more conducive to having families down there and to sort of reduce some of the just party atmosphere. And so there's been, over the years, there's been, you know, carnivals and rides and lots of things that are aimed at family entertainment more so than just drinking and listening to music. Now, I'm guessing at the 10 o'clock shows, there's probably not too many young people there, but yeah.
No, a lot of young people there.
Well, sorry.
Oh, kids.
I meant kids.
Yeah.
Not too many kids there.
If you could count the number of romances, including marriages, mm-hmm. that have begun in the Summerfest grounds.
Really?
Oh, it would be in the
yeah.
hundreds.
Really?
Certainly in the hundreds.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
People meeting each other there
mm-hmm.
and
yep.
then getting
yep.
married eventually?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
sure. It's
how
the old,
do you meet somebody? I mean, how do you even have a conversation? Isn't it kind of
well,
is it kind of love?
Go to the beer stand, and there are places to get out of the eddies and kind of have conversations. It's a lot like the... the old George Devine's $1 Million Ballroom at the Eagles Club, you know, in 26th or 24th in Wisconsin. No, that also had the same kind of magnetic effect for people getting together and starting romances. So I think there's a lot of, I'm sure you could probably do a Summerfest alumni.
We last summer we interviewed about 300 people on the grounds during Summerfest, you know, getting them to tell us about their favorite memory, their favorite band, their favorite, you know, day at Summerfest, and a huge number of them were talking about their first date, you know, or, you know, meeting somebody for the first time and stuff like that. So John's definitely correct that it is a site for romance.
And it was also, you know, a place for a safe, neutral, common ground space for kids to kind of you know, begin to move into the adult society.
Yes.
One of my favorite memories of Summerfest is I've got three kids who are now in their 30s, but I took my sons who were then probably, boy, maybe 10 and 13, 14 through there, to their very first concert, which was Yes, you know, the prog rock band mm-hmm. at the Marcus Amphitheater.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I saw them this weekend, and they both still have really clear and very fond
oh, do
memories
they really? Oh, that's
of
nice.
That concert. Then later on, I was telling my oldest son, Nikolai, I was saying, yeah, then maybe 10 years later, you were walking one way with a beer, and I was walking the other way with a beer. So there's kind of a maturation process that goes on.
Let's try the phones one more time and see if they might be working. Kimi, are you there? Hello?
Hello?
Oh, my gosh. We have... Okay, now the phones are working. Great. Go ahead, Kimi.
Okay, I was in... I went to see the Jackson 5 in 1972 for 50 cents, and our parents dropped us off there.
50?
And it was, you know, a very excited young crowd, and in front of me was a father with his kids, and he was very patiently sitting while all the young people were up standing on the folding chairs and dancing, and... people in back started getting irritated and yelling down in front and stuff like that. And this very patient dad sitting in front of me, someone threw a folding chair from the back and it clocked him right in the back of his skull.
Oh, no.
And he went out.
Ooh.
So, yeah, it was terrible. And my friend and I ran up to the stage and got the security guard and told him about the guy. And then, of course, we got to watch the rest of it from standing right at the foot of the stage because we weren't going to go back to our seats after that. But they sent someone back, and they picked up this guy, and they carried him up and across the stage, unconscious. And the boys singing, you know, they didn't miss a step, but they did. Their heads did turn, and they watched this guy go across the stage. And I have always wondered... what happened to that father who got whacked by the chair? I just always have, I don't know if there's any way to you know, find out whatever happened to him.
Ben, do you know?
I don't know. I hadn't heard that story, but that's pretty amazing.
Maybe he'll call in. Maybe he'll call in.
Yeah.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice? Maybe he'll call in, Sean. Maybe he will. Well, stuff like that is bound to happen when you get a huge number of people and a sufficient amount of alcohol, mm-hmm. I'm afraid, too, that... that, you know, some things can happen.
Yeah, the famous one was Humble Pie back in 1973,
right,
when there actually was a good outbreak of violence, 300 arrests, something like that.
Yeah, it's 300.
And there was a good line, Joel McNally from the Journal back in those days. He said that was the most excited reaction to any band that included Peter Frampton.
Very good.
Kimi, thanks for the call. Let's go to John in Burlington. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Just a little story here about how things have changed. I was in high school, and we went to Summerfest, and the night of George Carlin, Siegel Schwal, Brewer and Shipley, and Arlo Guthrie.
Whoa.
Ooh.
Yeah, and the reason I know that is I brought my home Super 8 movie camera, and my friend brought a reel-to-reel tape deck. They allowed us in.
Oh, I remember those. I love those.
They let you in?
They not only let us in, but the stage crew ran a power cord out so we could run the
tape. Boy, imagine that today.
I have the 18 minutes of my Super 8 movie still in my box, but lost track of Jim, who had the tape deck. I just hope he still got the tape for it. But what a night. And times have changed. I don't think I'd be allowed to do that anymore.
I can tell you the Milwaukee County Historical Society would love to have your film. Correct, Ben?
I believe we do have your film.
Oh, really?
That's funny to say, because I did stop down. I enjoyed the exhibit.
Oh, okay.
I mentioned it to the man that was there.
Mm-hmm.
And all I got to do now is figure out a way to digitize it, because the film is, what, 40 years old or something now? So
yeah, give us a call. We can take care of that.
And you heard Carlin?
Pardon me?
Did you hear George Carlin?
Yes. Yeah,
so what did you...
heard the whole thing. I got 30 seconds of him standing there, but... without the tape, I can't.
Right.
I can't provide that at all.
No. What did you think when you were hearing it?
Weird. You know, we were high school, and you know, from small town Wisconsin, people shouldn't be saying those things. But we were trying to act cool. We were in high school, and you know, we went along with it. But yeah, quite a night.
Was that the act or the night when Arlo Guthrie was there with Pete Seeger?
No, it wasn't Pete Seeger.
Okay.
Brewer and Shipley, you know, one
okay,
talk over the
right,
line.
Right.
And Arlo Guthrie, Siegel Schwal, which Corky Siegel still playing music.
Sure. Yeah. That,
yeah. And,
I recall that reunion show.
I don't remember the order. I think Siegel Schwal was first, but George Carlin then was, I think if he wasn't last, he was close. So
I recall a concert with Arlo Guthrie, and it was on the old main stage, which was on the north side of the grounds, and he and Pete Seeger were together, and
nice.
they took turns, and they still have this really sharp image of Guthrie playing probably Alice's Restaurant, and Pete Seeger kind of just sitting cross-legged on the stage waiting for his turn to come on again.
So wow.
Really
I'm
kind of Americana.
It could have been. I probably didn't know who Pete Seeger was at that time, but
it
very well could have been. If he played there only once, it would have been that thing. So.
That's back in the days when that main stage, it looked like it had a canopy on top. It looked like kind of a Lady Gaga brassiere. You know?
I kind of remember sitting on railroad ties. I don't think there were real clear, you know, benches or anything like that, bleachers. It was pretty rudimentary.
Primitive.
Absolutely a blast.
Yeah, great. Thanks very much for your call.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Our number is 800-486-8655. Our phones are up and running again. Hooray. And we go to Regan in Rhinelander. Hi.
I got cut off before, but that's okay. Listen, I went for the first 3 years. I originally went to Woodstock. I did stage security there and helped build the stage.
Ah.
So then I had my original school bus from Woodstock parked at the lakefront for 3 years in the summer. They used to let you do that back then. There was half a dozen different hippie school buses there. Anyways, I remember when Mountain played, it was raining. If you guys could refresh my mind, get it? The second year, I think they played. Wasn't it?
I don't recall Mountain
don't
being
know.
There. Not myself. I was not a major Mountain fan back in those years.
I don't even know who they are. Yeah. Are your memory?
And somebody threw a beer bottle at the drummer, and they were going to leave. And they weren't that popular yet. But like you said, Humble Pie, the third year, I remember how that was when Sly and the Family Stone was late. But what was interesting is just how the east side and the lakefront was interconnected back then. And there was just this flow of people that went back and forth, and it was a good time. Yeah, there was some violence and stuff like that then, too. But it was pretty cool.
Yeah. I don't think of Summerfest as being a violent festival.
No.
There were incidents of problems, but it's not been a lot of them.
No, when you put a million people down there for 11 days, you know,
right.
you're going
right.
to have not everyone is going to be a Boy Scout or Girl Scout,
right.
But I think on the long term average is really high in terms of civil behavior and a good time for all.
Yeah, and did it start very just a couple days the festival? Because 11 days is a long time for a festival. Did it start that way?
It started with a full 10 to 12
it
days.
It did,
yeah.
Really?
That was the vision. And as John alluded to earlier, the first two festivals were spread out all over the city, and there were a number of events. I mean, they tied it in with an air show the first year and things like that. So it was, in that regards, it was relatively easy to get a full 11 days of activity. You know, there was a car race at the Milwaukee Mile that was associated with it and a lot of stuff. So, yeah, from the very beginning, they went for the full week and a half.
Hmm. Let us go to Connie in Fort Atkinson. Hello, Connie.
Hello, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Great.
Good.
I'm intrigued by your conversation because I remember so much of it. My husband was a staff member of the early Summerfest and actually a City of Milwaukee employee when they started with the health department. And he was assigned to the position because he was a young guy in the health department and nobody else understood music. And that job eventually led to him becoming the food and beverage director when he worked with the Drilliuses. And then later he became the general manager of Summerfest and worked under Jim Butler, Rod Lanser, Joan Erden, Henry Jordan. And so as being his better half or his significant other at the time, he and I spent many, many, many hours at Summerfest, and it was a wonderful time to take it from mud and straw, from a lot of rain, to permanent buildings and asphalt.
What was his name?
His name is Tom Barbian.
Oh, sure, sure.
Sadly, Tom died 25 years ago, but his tradition carries on. My oldest son, Nick, has worked for Summerfest for 13 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Thanks, Connie. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Let's go to Brian in Franklin. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thank you. My first memory, if I get the year right, was when Sly and the Family Stone. And what year was that, did you say?
1970.
Oh, that was
early. That was a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
I got there with my brother and some of his buddies, and we got there probably around noon, and, you know, I don't remember there being any benches. We just sat on the ground, and I was facing the stage, and like good Milwaukee boys, we sat there and played euchre all afternoon long.
Not sheepshead.
No, not sheepshead. We went through that stage already. We were into euchre. And my back was to the crowd that was forming behind me, and when I eventually stood up, back in those days, I could sit for a long time. And eventually, I stood up and looked back, and just as far as you could see, there was people. It was just amazing.
Yeah, that was 125,000 people.
Huh. That's amazing.
Don't hate the black.
Oh, here we are. All right, we got our music back, I think, too. We're going
to need to go to the bathroom because we're all dehydrated from sitting in the sun.
Let's try and listen to a little bit of Sly. Not from that concert, but a voice from the past. Of Summerfest this hour. We'll continue with our historians in a moment. The Rolling Stones played in 2015 and just 15 cities on their North American tour. Chicago wasn't on the tour, but Milwaukee was on the tour. And Ben, I've read that Milwaukee was by far the smallest venue for a tour that mostly played at football stadiums. That's pretty amazing that the Rolling Stones came to Summerfest, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Summerfest venue was a third of the size of the other venues that they were playing at on that tour.
So. Do you know how that happened? Did somebody know somebody in the band or what?
I mean, maybe that's the magic of Bob Babish. It's hard to say how he pulled that off. But, I mean, his reputation is vast and strong. And so, and again, like we were talking about earlier, people really like playing Summerfest. So they take the opportunity when they get it.
Yeah. So there is something, and I want to know what people have said about performing here, that there's something different. If you're at a football stadium, your experience as a performer, I think, is much different than if you're at a slightly more intimate setting on the lakefront at front of Lake Michigan with other music venues around you. It must be a different kind of performing experience.
Well, I can't say I've talked to people who've played there. I know one issue for musicians, and you'll hear it from the stage, is the bleed of the music from one stage to another. And they've tried to adjust the angle of the stages so that's less an issue. In the early years, the amplifiers were facing the third ward, which was not very not very populated back then. No, there were, I think, fewer than 100 people there back when Summerfest was beginning. But that became obviously much more an issue as the third ward got hotter and hotter and hotter. So they've kind of adapted their sound design to be much less intrusive. But I think part of the kind of just projecting on the part of a musician is kind of fun to be part of that buzz. You know, mm-hmm. you get your own main stage, and then you kind of are part of a much larger organism, which mm-hmm. Summerfest is, definitely.
Yeah, it is. Thank you so much for the call. We got a caller from Bonn, Germany. Katie is calling. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm so happy that it's actually at the same time zone.
What?
Really?
Are you in Germany?
I'm in Germany, yeah.
You're not in the
and
same time zone.
Thank you. Most of my political news I get from your show.
Oh, you're kidding. They're in Bonn, Germany. Isn't that great?
I'm in Bonn, Germany, and I'm a Wisconsinite. So I just wanted to tell you that my first concert was in 1986, Bryan Adams, at that rainstorm.
Oh.
And we were there. I was 14 at the time. My parents dropped me off with a bunch of my girlfriends.
Oh.
And we ended up getting all separated because we were taking turns holding the seats.
Oh.
No cell phones.
Yeah, so corn in the cob with braces was not a good thing. We ended up all getting separated, and he was able to play just, I think, three or four songs before the actual, all of the music went down because of the lightning. And there were people that were riding porta potties.
Oh, my goodness.
The streets of Milwaukee, and someone actually ended up picking me up because I got separated and brought me to a hotel where I called my parents to ask me to pick me up, which they were not happy about that. But I met friends for my life there at that same hotel. We're still in contact.
No.
And it's that experience that has brought us together, and we stayed together.
So weren't you a little bit frantic when all of that was happening? You lost your friends? You were 14
I
years
was,
old?
I was, but it was Milwaukee. It was, I don't know, it was Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
You're always among friends, right? Isn't that the...
right.
So do you have a T-shirt saying I survived Bryan Adams at the age of 14?
I should have, but when I heard that, I was like, oh my gosh, this is such a great... Because I haven't been to Summerfest, I don't know, I've been here for 25 years, so I haven't been to Summerfest since I've been here, so it just brought back such great memories.
Oh,
thank you so much for the show.
Thanks, Katie, for calling from Germany. I didn't imagine anybody listening.
Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, she could have one of those shirts made.
Yeah,
that would be a nice thing for her to have.
So porta potties floating down the street from Milwaukee.
I know, it really,
that's a visual.
Yeah,
it really is.
That does not seem pleasant.
John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah,
hey, John.
Two memories, one old, one recent, and then a question. And the first was in 82, I saw the Santana band there, and it was unbelievable. They played for probably 3.5 hours, it seemed. It was a long time. And I've seen Carlos Santana 4 times, and it's, that show seemed like they were in their element. And he has described it as a spiritual place for him, Milwaukee, or playing there at Summerfest. I forget which, even though there was that one movie that described Milwaukee as hell. And, you know, and I was like, oh, you guys don't get it. But, you know, they were being goofy.
But Santana did.
Yeah, Santana got it. Thank you very much, John, for your call. Larry in Delafield, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Great show. I was a student at Marquette University in the late 60s and went to the concert at the lakefront, and it was all muddy. There was just benches and a rickety stage. And a fella that I went to high school with on the south side of Chicago was playing in a band called Chicago Area Transit Authority.
Sure, I remember them.
The CTA.
Right.
I went to school with Peter Cetera. Mm-hmm. And these guys weren't even known. I mean, they showed up at this concert. They were just barely getting started. And I couldn't believe nobody knew of this band. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what year that was, or if it was a precursor to Summerfest. Mm.
Ben, do you know?
I don't know.
John?
My guess would be probably that first, you know, there were youth acts in the first 2 years at the lakefront, even though it was spread all over the place. So that's about the time Chicago's coming into popularity, 68, 69. And who knows, maybe they were easier to book because they only had to come from 90 miles away.
Right.
And what a nice thing to be able to say that the best performance he ever saw by Santana, a band he's seen many, many times, was at Summerfest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And people do that. People go to the bands and see the same band all the time, don't they?
Oh, sure. Every show's different. I mean, the Grateful Dead were there, so that's... I mean,
yes.
People would just devote their lives to following the Dead around the United States.
And, yeah.
Seeing how they vary their set list.
Did you ever see them?
Not at Summerfest. I saw them out east.
Did you?
In Boston, but not in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I never saw them. Prince performed at Summerfest too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
2009 was it?
I don't know. I don't know the year.
So the exhibit is when? Where can people see the Summerfest exhibit?
It is in place at the Historical Society. We're going to keep it up through September 29th.
Okay.
And it's. It's really a full look at all 50 years of Summerfest, but with a real heavy emphasis on sort of the early history.
Great.
And third and Kilbourne down there in the wonderful
Absolutely.
Old bank building.
And John, tell us whichever of your books has most about Summerfest in it.
The Making of Milwaukee, without
Excellent.
A doubt.
Making of Milwaukee. Yep. Thank you both so much for being with us. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great to have both of you. John Gerda, of course, a Milwaukee-born writer and historian. Many, many books. His book, The Making of Milwaukee, adapted into an Emmy Award-winning documentary series on Milwaukee Public Television. And we thank Ben Barbera, curator and operations manager at the Milwaukee County Historical Society. He curated the exhibit he was just talking about for Summerfest's 50th anniversary. And I told you I had something to say to you, so I've reserved the last couple of minutes of this show for me, and also for you. And it's the time. The years have gone by, and the time has come for me to leave my career in radio, which started, if you can believe this, 44 years ago, during Watergate. And the best 24 years have certainly been with Wisconsin Public Radio. My last broadcast is going to be August 10th. And you, our audience, just listen to the calls we've had this hour. We always get these kinds of calls. You've been participating partners in this journey. We have spoken with thousands of people, presidents, authors, scientists, teachers, truck drivers, historians, community leaders, artists and entertainers, experts in every imaginable field. And what do they all say? Your listeners ask the best questions, or, oh, what a great insight you offered. Among my many memories are Studs Terkel doing the last interview of his life with us, Judy Collins singing Amazing Grace live in our studio, a remote broadcast with ever so intelligent students and teachers from Rufus King High School shortly after 9/11, another from Dubuque, Iowa for the 2008 presidential caucuses where you brought a room full of chocolate cakes, interviews we had with prominent biographers. We all have more knowledge of Lincoln, Washington, FDR, Garfield, Grant, Eisenhower, Teddy Roosevelt, Jefferson, John Adams, John Quincy Adams, Nixon, Obama, Clinton, Truman, Einstein, Martin Luther King, Abigail Adams, Dylan, Aretha, the Beatles, and so many others. Each day, I would eagerly head for class and learn from great teachers. And through the radio, I gotta tell you, I've received a world-class education. Brain and heart have been nourished, and you also made very strong connection with our guests. After listening to Maya Angelou remember her grandmother, a young listener who had just lost her dear grandmother spoke through her tears about her upcoming wedding and how she would miss her grandma. And Maya sent her a wedding present. Senator Bob Dole received a call from a listener from Dole's hometown of Russell, Kansas, and he shared memories of the senator's father. World War II, Korean War, Vietnam vets spoke to each other. One World War II vet was asked to write a book following his radio appearance, which he did. You, the listeners, have always been a large part of the essence of every show. We all did our homework, but you gave the show intelligence and compassion, a variety of viewpoints and spontaneity. And you give me hope that the world will become a better place. I will miss you. I thank the many producers who have read widely, came to work each day in good spirits, and worked so hard with creative minds to find people who would enlighten us. Their work is so incredibly important, and many are dear friends. Those of you who have listened regularly understand that among my abiding interests are these two, Abraham Lincoln and dogs. Unfortunately, A. Lincoln is no longer with us, but dogs are, and I will be devoting much of my time to raising and training a therapy dog. Finn has been born and will join our family in mid-August, and I hope that he and I can bring comfort and happiness to many. I thank WPR for giving me so many years of a life with daily meaning, and I ask you, who could ask for anything more? I'll be with you till August 10th.